before joining the agency in 1951. After running a small, dozen-person chemistry division inside the technical services staff for 6 years in the mid-1950s, he took a 2-year assignment in Germany before returning to Washington in 1959 to head the TSS Research and Development Program. Krueger, who had been the young tech who installed the secret microphones and recorders in Dulles's office and served as the DCI's technical tutor, then moved on to the CIA's U-2 and radar programs. Now, steeped in the science of big technology, he was returning to the basics of espionage tradecraft. Barely a decade old, TSD had expanded from fewer than 50 technicians in 1951 to an office of several hundred engineers, craftsmen, scientists, psychologists, artists, printers, and technical specialists. After 1962, with the formation of a separate CIA Directorate of Research, TSD existed solely to support operations, with 20% of its staff assigned to a network of forward-deployed bases overseas. With the exception of denied areas, such as the USSR and China, these dispersed technical specialists could be summoned to any part of the world to provide immediate support to an operations officer. If an operation called for concealing a camera, secreting a microphone in the office of a target, or installing a phone tap, the tech could provide it, install it, or fashion a custom version from off-the-shelf parts. If something didn't work, the tech could repair it. Moreover, if it still did not function, the tech could figure out a workaround from whatever materials were at hand. Among the newer case officers, the techs were becoming prized for their ingenuity as well as their engineering skills in the field, but there were serious limitations. Many other officers, while not exactly technophobes, did not fully embrace technology. Operations were generally conducted using World War II tradecraft refined by personal experience. When TSD techs were brought in for their expertise or gadgets, their assistance was not often viewed as critical for either the successful day-to-day agent operations or an ops officer's career. It was nice to have the techs there when we needed them, but if we didn't have their gadgets, we still ran the operation, said one case officer active during the early 1960s. The necessary technologies for miniaturization, low power, and reliable electronics were in their infancy. Both the scientific advances of the 1960s and the leadership of Russell and Dr. Gottlieb would be required before technology and operations would become interdependent. Russell, who lived for operations, was also one of a handful of senior case operations officers of his generation who understood the potential advantage technology could give to operations. When you went to one of Russell's stations overseas, you saw good technical skills meshing with ops. He really sucked the techs dry in terms of wanting to know what they could provide and how it was going to happen, said one TSD veteran. A lot of station chiefs literally didn't want to know that tech stuff, but Russell wanted to know it all. Over the next 4 years, the Russell-Gottlieb-Krueger team proved to be an inspired, if unlikely, trio. This combination of a case officer with no scientific experience, a scientist of limited operational experience, and an engineer steeped in big technology programs would transform TSD. Eventually, this new organization would play a major role in nearly every significant CIA operation for the remainder of the 20th century. Russell wasted no time in exerting his influence on TSD. He conveyed a sense of operational reality and urgency that made the case officer's concerns for recruiting and handling spies a concern for his engineers, while daily advances in technology began to influence his vision of operations. However, Russell and the TSD faced a problem unrelated to technology, that of the tightly compartmented world of the agency itself. Although TSD was a global division, its technical officers were rarely privy to the details or scope of the operations they supported. Compartmentation sealed off all but the basic facts of an operation to anyone who did not have an absolute need to know. This constraint was of little consequence if the requirement was to secretly photograph a document or prepare a dead drop container. However, with more sophisticated and flexible technology becoming available, the more the techs knew, the better they could match TSD expertise and technology to the operation. This was a place where compartmentation and need to know were at odds, said one case officer. To perform the task perfectly, the tech should know everything. But in our world, the techs weren't allowed to know everything. Compartmentalization is a necessary fact of life. Along with this situation, which separated the tech and the case officer, there also existed a subtle cultural divide. In the DDP, the case officer was the star player. The culture of the DDP had evolved from the OSS. The Ivy League image that once prompted derision in the press and the oh-so-social sobriquet carried over with the former OSS officers who were among the founding members of the CIA. DCI Alan Dulles had an Ivy League background, Princeton, class of 1914, and an association with New York's powerful white shoe law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Richard Helms, later a DCI himself, had attended boarding schools overseas, including the prestigious Swiss prep school Le Rosay, before attending Williams College. OSS head William Donovan, although not from a wealthy family, attended Columbia University, class of 1905, and its law school, class of 1907. DCI William Colby, the son of an Army officer, graduated from Princeton and Columbia University Law School. DCI Bill Casey, who graduated from Fordham University, Catholic University School of Social Work, and Brooklyn Law School, represented the exception that proved the rule. President Lyndon Johnson may have been thinking of the historical characterization of the so-called blue-blooded case officer when he said, "The CIA is made up of boys whose families sent them to Princeton, but wouldn't let them into the family brokerage business." Conversely, TSS, and later TSD, included few famous family names or Ivy League bona fides, with the notable exception of Cornelius Corny V.S. Roosevelt, grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, who served as director of TSS-TSD from 1959 to 1962. The reason for this was quite simple. For the most part, the OSS technical and engineering staff returned to their corporate or university laboratories after the war ended in 1945. By 1951, when Alan Dulles authorized the formation of TSS, the agency turned to state universities, technical colleges, and institutes where engineering programs were emphasized to hire its first wave of technical officers. Typically, these technical recruits had shown a childhood penchant for tinkering that eventually turned into engineering and hard science degrees. They were often the first or only member of their family to attend college, and many came from rural communities in the Midwest and Southwest. They arrived at the CIA seeking technical opportunities and adventure. It did not take long before these newly minted engineers began delighting in calling operations officers liberal arts majors. For engineers, this less than flattering term summed up both a case officer's educational background and the imprecise, unscientific nature of agent recruiting and handling. Case officers, for their part, had their own traditions. In theory, spies are acquired through a methodical process of spotting, assessing, developing, recruiting, and handling. All of it was usually done person to person. While living in Switzerland during World War II, Alan Dulles met with agents in his well-appointed study. Penkovsky was met and debriefed in hotel rooms. Face-to-face meetings between the agent and case officer were common practice. Agents were briefed, debriefed, and tasked in safe houses and out-of-the-way restaurants over leisurely dinners. These meetings built rapport, mutual trust, and personal relationships that often approached friendship. Despite the inherent manipulation, deception, and potential for fatal consequences, the handler and spy worked as a team, with the best case officers also playing the role of a psychologist, cheerleader, banker, confidant, or best friend, depending on the needs of the agent. Given the limited capabilities of most counterintelligence services after World War II, this process worked well until the 1960s. Highly valued spies such as Pyotr Popov and Penkovsky could use commercial cameras, pass film to their handlers via dead drops, receive messages in the form of strings of random numbers over a standard shortwave radio, and decrypt those numbers with OTPs like those used by the French or Polish underground in occupied Europe. As a result, case officers were generally passive toward technology's potential in operations. We didn't comprehend what was there technically, and either took a defensive position of operational arrogance or retreated into a shell of saying, "Look, there's no way I will ever understand what you tech types are doing, and if the success of this operation depends on me understanding, then we're just not going to make it," remembers one case officer. For case officers, lacking a clear understanding of technology meant not grasping its potential, while techs ran the danger of either misapplying technology or failing to capitalize on some special advantage. This attitude was especially frustrating for the eager engineers of TSS seeking insight into what was really needed in the field. Highlighting the separateness between operations and technology was the fact that TSD did not receive space in the new Langley CIA headquarters building where the DDP operational components resided. 6 miles separated TSD's downtown Washington location from Langley, a distance that precluded the professional lubrication of drop-in meetings, cafeteria luncheon conversations, or office gossip. Russell and Gottlieb, both with operational experience, understood this divide and undertook the task of bridging it. Clearly, there was a cultural division, no question about that. When Sid Gottlieb came back from Germany in 1959 to head TSD's research and development work, his approach was, "Yes, there is this divide, but it needn't be there. And TSD has to bridge it, because the DDP won't," explained a TSD engineer. Gottlieb was right on the mark. Ultimately, the DDP controlled the operations, the dollars, and the manpower, so if TSD was to get the funds and requirements needed to be successful, it had to become part of operations. One of Gottlieb's first moves was to bring research and development closer to the techs directly supporting operations. Less obvious at the time was the significance of the creation of the Directorate of Research in 1962. With this decision, R&D supporting the big technology of aerospace and satellite programs became independent from the DDP. TSD remained in the DDP with the single mission of operational support, specifically technical support to stations, case officers, and agents. Gottlieb and Russell saw a future in which TSD technology would enable operations through new tradecraft devices and techniques. The big technology of satellites and photo reconnaissance had proven successful on a large scale in the relatively predictable environment of space. Now, TSD had the opportunity to demonstrate how sophisticated, scaled-down technology could expand the scope of what was possible in the unpredictable environment of street operations. This ambitious strategy first had to address some immediate and not altogether pleasant realities. Much of the equipment in TSD's inventory was woefully outdated, and the technical staff seemed imbalanced toward technicians at the expense of engineers. As late as 1960, most electronic gear available for field deployment was too big, too cumbersome, too unreliable, too complex, and too power-hungry. In the decidedly blunt terminology of one scientist of the day, the equipment was junk. What Russell and Gottlieb had was largely a craft and special service boutique for operations. TSD could provide excellent forged documents, quality clandestine printing, and well-made concealments. But that was insufficient to meet the DDP's demands for conducting clandestine operations against the Soviet Union. TSD leadership had two mountains to climb. One was the technology, which was pretty bad, said a TSD staffer from the era. For instance, with secret writing, we were issuing systems that Caesar could have used during the Gallic Wars. We use systems that were developed during the First World War. We weren't taking advantage of post-World War II chemistries, and the opposition, the Soviets, certainly had the capability to detect our existing systems. So we had to get better technology. Second, we had to convince working-level case officers that we had something to contribute. But it, the technology, wasn't on our shelves, so we'd have to develop the new capabilities and the new equipment across the board. In chemistry, Gottlieb's field, the few academically degreed chemists directing research were trained prior to World War II. Other TSD chemists and techs supporting secret writing in the field were former military medics with no professional training. To remedy this problem, Gottlieb and Russell began recruiting university graduates, scientists and engineers, rather than technicians, specifically for R&D. Their strategy was to exploit the current science from university and research centers and package it quickly into viable, covert systems. Russell broke ties with the agency's Office of Personnel, TSD's traditional source of new hires, at the urging of his R&D chief, and began sending senior officers to universities to talk to engineers and recruit new graduates. A co-op program was started in which college sophomores and juniors were hired for a summer or school term and put to work in a lab. An instant success, the co-op program offered a view into the newest research at the universities and allowed TSD to assess a potential employee before making a long-term commitment. In a bit of clever bureaucratic maneuvering, the division skirted personnel ceilings by hiring engineers as contract employees on 2-year contracts. Not counted as permanent CIA staff, they fell outside the personnel ceiling limitation. The contracts could be renewed every 2 years as long as sufficient funds were available, and TSD always found the dollars. I came in as part of Gottlieb's program to hire these young people with fresh ideas just out of graduate school. I remember sitting in my first SW, secret writing, course. Several of us newly hired chemists started giggling at the 1930s technology the instructor was giving us, said one chemist. We'd sneak in a question, does this d-orbital? The instructor didn't know the term d-orbital, an advanced chemistry term related to the subatomic properties of certain substances, such as crystals and metals. I'm picking on one guy on one point, but that illustrates the level on which the chemical technology existed. The new hires had a profound impact on TSD's technology. Young chemists improved formulas and processes for SW that had remained unchanged for decades. The SW chemists referred to themselves as lemon squeezers, in acknowledgement of one of the oldest SW ingredients, lemon juice. In World War II, secret messages were prepared with a wooden stick and a little bit of water-based ink, explained an SW chemist. The agent would dissolve the ink chemical, stir it around, take a small piece of cotton, wrap it around the end of the stick, and dip it in. He had to first steam the paper, then write the message, re-steam the paper, and then press the paper flat. Finally, he had to write a cover message over the top of the secret writing. Although not particularly complex, the laborious multi-step process required time to complete, and given the limited privacy in many apartments behind the Iron Curtain, was not very practical. About the time I was hired, we understood the Russians and the British did it a little bit differently, and much more securely. My guess is that's when management finally realized we were far behind the curve in SW chemistry, said the chemist. Why are we using this liquid stuff? Why couldn't we do it dry? If the operations officers were not immediately aware of the changes taking place, there were good reasons. TSD had not been moved into CIA's new headquarters building at Langley in 1961 with the other DDP divisions. Rather, in 1965, TSD consolidated many, but not all, of its functions into 3 buildings, Central, East, and South, at the original CIA complex in Washington, D.C., on E Street on Medicine Hill next to the State Department. The TSD chief and deputy chief occupied offices formerly used by Dulles and other CIA directors. The consolidation improved communications among the techs, but required a 6-mile trip from South Building to Langley for the techs to meet with the case officers. By the late 1960s, Gottlieb's focus on hiring engineers and scientists, combined with adequate funding from the DDP and revolutionary technology, had transformed TSD. In audio surveillance and secret writing, the technical advances produced new capabilities to meet technical support requirements in Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and much of Asia. The exceptions were China, the Soviet Union, the Soviet bloc, and Cuba, denied area operations countries where direct access to targets was nearly impossible and internal security strict. Yet, outside of the Vietnam War, these were the countries of highest priority for U.S. intelligence, a major initiative to make technology that would work in the toughest environments was demanded. The Soviet Union presented a special set of operational problems. One involved the very technology that could help operations. The KGB, under its chief Yuri Andropov, fielded one of the most pervasive counterintelligence services imaginable. By virtue of its primary mission, to protect the revolution, the KGB regarded the Soviet citizenry, foreigners, and emerging consumer technologies with deep suspicion. For the KGB, even simple technology in the hands of the public was a potential threat to the government and state security. Virtually every typewriter sold in the Soviet Union, for example, had its font sampled on a sheet of paper that was then filed away should the need ever arise to trace the origins of a suspicious document. Complex procedures granting access to copy machines in government offices included signed authorizations and meticulously kept logs of the copies produced. Even consumer items commonly available in the West, such as Kodak point-and-shoot cameras, electric appliances, and battery-powered transistor radios, could not be purchased in the USSR. A typical Soviet possessing such Western-made items would assuredly draw KGB attention. For agents to operate in this security-obsessed environment with its deep suspicion of technology, TSD would need to develop an array of special cameras, communications equipment, concealments, and counter-surveillance devices. Chapter 6. Building Better Gadgets. The game is so large that one sees but a little at a time. Rudyard Kipling, Kim. Russell saw a new role for technology, particularly in its potential for enhancing agent communications. For a spy, the greatest danger usually is not stealing a secret, but rather passing it to his handler. Covert communication, known as COVCOM, dominated operational planning. Without the means to transfer information securely between agent and handler, espionage could not exist. The most secure covert communication system was an impersonal exchange that separated the agent and case officer by distance, time, place, or some combination of the three. The tradecraft lexicon is filled with colorful phrases for impersonal exchanges of information. The best-known method, and most widely used, is called dead drop by the CIA, Tynik by the Soviets, and dead letterbox by the British. Another personal exchange, the brush pass, requires the agent and handler to walk close enough to each other so that a note or package can be dropped or passed quickly and discreetly. The drop might be made into an open shopping bag or handed off folded into the morning's newspaper. The car toss, a variation of the brush pass, involves throwing a package through an open window of a slowly moving vehicle. What these pieces of tradecraft have in common is the goal of minimizing the time agent and handler spend in the same place at the same time. With some techniques, such as with the brush pass, the time is reduced to a fraction of a second. Nevertheless, even the seemingly insignificant half-second required to make a successful brush pass brings the agent and handler to the same place at the same time. In hostile areas, such as Moscow, mere proximity of two individuals could arouse suspicion. Was it possible that in Moscow, a city of millions, an American would, by chance, bump shoulders with a leading scientist on a streetcar? The KGB would not believe in such chance encounters. Their view might well have been derived from the legendary New York Yankees catcher Yogi Berra, who is reputed to have said, "That's too coincidental to be coincidence." Dead drops, a preferred means of covert communication in denied areas, separate the agent and handler by time, but carry the risk of leaving the package unattended in an environment that could change without warning. A concealment package left at the site could be found by an unwitting passerby or buried by an unexpected snowstorm. The act of loading or clearing the drop site, if it appeared unnatural, could draw suspicion. Russell, the case officer now surrounded by engineers, proposed a solution for improved agent communications that was both ingenious and technologically elegant. A TSD audio surveillance engineer remembered receiving an unexpected call from the chief. Russell called me up one day in early 1963 and said, "I was just thinking last night, if you compromise your audio operation by telling the agent where a hidden microphone is, he can talk near it, and you have a one-way communication system." Soon afterward, Tex began suggesting to case officers that audio devices or bugs previously used exclusively for audio surveillance could become a one-way communication system if an agent knew he could be heard through a concealed mic and transmitter. The result became known as an audio dead drop. In one Western European city, TSD Tex planted a microphone in a tree in a park. To communicate with his handler, the agent talked to the tree. I remember one time we bugged the exterior of a building so our guy could pause at the corner of the building, say whatever he had to say, and keep on walking, a TSD staffer recalled. We really got involved in that. Audio dead drops took off like gangbusters once we started, and it all began with Russell. Imagining a dignified diplomat pausing and muttering a few words into a tree trunk seems comical. Yet the humor is overshadowed by considering how dramatically this new capability expanded the options for communication beyond the chalk marks for signals or loading and unloading dead drops, the level of tradecraft employed by Penkovsky. However, even with the clever audio dead drop, two-way impersonal covert communications inside the Soviet Union remained the prize, a necessary weapon to counter the massive security apparatus of the KGB's 2nd and 7th directorates. Taking on the KGB inside the USSR began modestly when TSD launched operations to identify the postal censorship techniques used by the Soviets to monitor and examine both internal and international mail. In one basic method of covert communication, an ordinary letter with standard text could also contain a hidden message in secret writing. Mixed in with millions of pieces of mail, cover letters with non-alerting descriptions of vacations and family news could be virtually undetectable. Since World War II, agents working for U.S. intelligence had routinely written and received hundreds of secret writing messages from most areas of the world. But the Soviet Union was different from most of the world. The KGB watched the mail going in and out of the USSR assiduously. Soviet postal censors were well aware of SW techniques, and the KGB unapologetically opened and inspected the mail of its citizens and foreigners alike. However, since even the KGB could not open, read, and test every single letter, the TSD staff theorized that the Soviets must have censorship protocols. If TSD could understand the systematic organizational sieve that captured and flagged suspicious letters, then they could defeat it. For us, the question was always, what is the decision process that gets a particular letter routed to the KGB's chemist inside Moscow's central post office? Once that happened, once the letter is suspect, and your guy, whether sender or receiver, is in trouble, said a TSD staffer. Their chemist may not have confirmed it yet, but there was something, an anomaly, that the first-line postal censor, who is not a chemist, sensed or saw. Why did he pull that letter aside? Why was that one sent over there to the chemist? In an exercise called probing, TSD staffers directed the mailing of hundreds of test letters in and out of the Soviet Union with a seemingly endless number of permutations, including date and time of mailing, site of postal box, country of destination, type of letter or postcard, and whether it was written or typed. Probing continued for several years, with the letters varying in